The assassination or the killing of Kennedy in 63 or 62, President of the United States of America. Why? We want to know who killed him.
One of the more bizarre moments through a translator there of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's speech, or should I say 94-minute rant at the United Nations yesterday. He was supposed to get 15 minutes, but I guess for Gaddafi, when you want 15 minutes of fame, you take 15 and 15 and 15 and 15. There was actually a very serious issue kind of hidden in that speech that the media isn't talking about much because it's much easier to make fun of him, and we will talk about that. But there's also breaking news from the United Nations Security Council this morning that seems really significant. The Security Council, a little while ago, unanimously approved a resolution, unanimously, aimed at ridding the world of nuclear weapons, with Russia, China, and developing nations supporting the U.S.-sponsored measure. The resolution calls for stepped-up efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, promote disarmament, and reduce the risk of nuclear terrorism. President Obama chaired the meeting, the first American president to preside over a Security Council summit, and announced that the draft resolution has been adopted unanimously. He said the historic resolution we just adopted enshrines our shared commitment to a goal of a world without nuclear weapons, and it brings Security Council agreement on a broad framework for action to reduce nuclear dangers as we work toward that goal. Well, joining me to talk about this resolution, Gaddafi, will play some clips from other speeches yesterday that haven't gotten as much attention, are Chidanan Rajgata, foreign editor and U.S. correspondent for The Times of India, and Colm Lynch, U.N. correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks, both of you, for coming on WNYC today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Chidanan, you there? Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes, sir.
Okay. Colm, let me start with you. How significant is this resolution this morning? And is this just a way of trying to get tough on Iran, or is this the United States also saying, standing up and saying, we will reduce nuclear weapons, we go back to a long-abandoned goal of a nuclear-free world?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, essentially, I don't know that there are particularly measures in this resolution that are really incredibly groundbreaking. It reflects a lot of things that the Americans have committed to do, a lot of the sort of developments that have been taking place over the last couple of years on both nonproliferation, but particularly on nonproliferation. But what's significant about it is that Obama is framing the whole discussion within the United Nations context as a balance between disarmament, the requirements of the U.S. and other big powers, declared nuclear powers to reduce their stockpiles and to ultimately eliminate them, and the other side, which is putting pressure on governments like Iran and North Korea to get rid of either to get rid of their nukes or to not develop nuclear weapons. So the important thing is that this is sort of an important document. I mean, this is a document that everybody agrees on. It represents a certain amount of consensus, and it kind of frames this whole issue in a way that's not as contentious as it has been over the last couple of years during the Bush administration, where the focus in the UN was primarily on nonproliferation. One of the interesting things it does, I think it probably comes out much stronger in terms of specific concrete steps to put pressure on countries like North Korea and Iran. A couple of things that it does is, and there hasn't been much debate about this, is that in some sense it overtakes the primary treaty that oversees this issue, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. So let's say, you know, Iran or North Korea or some other country violates the terms of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and is doing something to develop a nuclear bomb. Traditionally, this issue would be taken up by the experts at the International Atomic Energy Agency, which can't sanction anybody, can't impose any kind of economic sanctions on anybody. But what this resolution does is says, no, if there's some sort of violation, then it comes directly to us. And this is something that a lot of countries in the developing world have been resisting, this notion of the Security Council taking on more and more authority, overtaking, you know, essentially moving into territory, which has been sort of where the rules have been set by an international treaty that's been signed and ratified by, you know, a large majority of nations. And here it is, the 15 members of the nation, the Security Council, starting to kind of usurp all this authority. So that's kind of some of the broader issues that are kind of, you know, kind of circulating around this building.
Interesting. And Chidanand, from the Times of India, India is a nuclear power. Does India read this as asking it to abandon nuclear weapons immediately or gradually?
Well, not really. India has been one of the earliest countries which, you know, pressed for disarmament and for abolition of nuclear weapons. If you recall, it took India a long time to make the sort of leap into the nuclear club. India first detonated its first nuclear device in 1974, and then waited 25 years for the rest of the world and primarily the P5 countries, the five Security Council principles, to live up to their commitment to abolish nuclear weapons. And when that did not happen, and when instead there was a pileup of nuclear weapons that reached really absurd proportions, was when India moved on, because it saw security threats in its neighborhood from Pakistan and China. And then in 1998 was when India went overtly nuclear, from being covertly nuclear for 25 years. So primarily India has no would have no problems with disarmament or eliminating nuclear weapons, because that's what India has always proposed. And in fact, going back to 1988, when the late Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi proposed eliminating nuclear weapons, India has waited for a long time.
So do you think that this resolution could actually, on a practical basis, move the world in that direction, including move the region with Pakistan and China included in that direction?
Well, that depends on what kind of example the United States sets. You know, this is not exactly a bombshell. I think from the time President Obama made his speech in Prague, where he first, laid out his vision, people have waited to hear more specific steps, more specific metrics.
And this was not it, you're saying?
Well, this is an expression of intent, an expression of sentiment, but I think people will wait to see whether numbers. And, the famous line from Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. So I think the rest of the world, particularly the smaller nuclear players like India, will want to see, what action the U.S. would initiate to, in terms of pure numbers, and B, in terms of, getting rogue nations which have proliferated nuclear weapons to contain them.
And Colin Lynch, does this put additional pressure on Iran, and the fact that Russia voted for this in a unanimous Security Council resolution, is that because of the abandonment of the missile defense for Eastern Europe that the president announced last week?
Well, I think it does add an additional layer of pressure. The Iranians have had a lot of pressure on them. The Security Council has been demanding for a couple of years now that they stop enriching nuclear fuel, that they stop doing a number of other sort of controversial activities. And the Russians and the Chinese have signed on to these resolutions demanding that they do this. Now, in the meeting yesterday between Medvedev and President Obama, there was some language coming out of that meeting suggesting that the Americans, that the Russians are more willing than they have been in the past to taking the position that we don't like sanctions, but they may, that they may be inevitable. What's interesting is the person who's probably has more influence on this than just about anybody else, which is their foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. He's been much more downbeat about the prospects for imposing sanctions. And so, there's been a lot of very kind of positive response to what came out of the meeting yesterday. But, when push comes to shove and they start getting in and negotiating a real resolution, talking about sanctions, I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians, sort of dig in their heels.
Right. All right. Let's talk about Gaddafi's speech yesterday, because people are making fun of the more bizarre parts of his 94-minute rant, and they were plenty. But there was a morsel of real substance there, which I think much of the world cares about, including reforming the UN Charter to give Africa a seat on the Security Council, which it currently does not have. Here's a clip.
The preamble says that the nations are equal, whether they are small or big. Are we equal in the permanent seats? No, we are not equals. And the preamble says that all nations are equal whether they are small nations or whether they are big nations, as far as the rights. Do we have the rights of the veto? Are we equals? The preamble says that we are equals in our rights, whether we are big or small. This is what is stated in the United Nations, and this is what we have agreed in the preamble. So the veto is against the charter.
So Chidanand Rajgata, foreign editor and U.S. correspondent for the Times of India, that was Gaddafi speaking through a translator at the United Nations. I know India wants a permanent seat on the United Nations General Assembly, feeling that India has that place in the world. China, same thing. Rather than let it sit with the old post-World War II order. And yet Gaddafi's making a point about Africa. Were people able to hear this, or was it just drowned out by his other more bizarre moments about reinvestigating the Kennedy assassination and things like that?
Yeah, you know, these pearls of wisdom from Muammar Gaddafi would have, you know, been taken more seriously if he were an elected leader of a country, you know, who had a more sober presence on the international stage. But you know, this is a man who's been out of the loop for 40 years. I mean, it's his first appearance, and you're right, it was a rant, and I think he was trying to make up for those 40-year absence by being there 94 minutes. I mean, really, you're right. There were some legitimate points he made, but I don't think anyone takes them seriously.
And he wasn't the only one making them. Of course, I misspoke a moment ago. China has a permanent seat on the Security Council, but India is looking for one because of its place in the world. And here's a clip from Russian leader Medvedev, also supporting the expansion of the Security Council.
Must adapt itself in a rational way to new global realities. It should strengthen its influence while preserving its multinational nature and the integrity of the UN Charter's provisions, of its key provisions. The most important component for the revitalization of the UN is Security Council reform. The time has come to step up the search for a compromise formula for its expansion. I'm referring to the expansion of the Security Council, and of course to increase the efficiency of this body.
And Colin Lynch from the Washington Post, Medvedev there speaking through a translator at the UN. Is this on the table? A lot of the world is apparently talking about expanding the Security Council. That's where the real power is in the United Nations. Is this something that might actually happen? Are the U.S. and China and France and the U.K. ready to share that power? And does it matter?
My feeling, I mean, it's almost like what Obama said about, you know, a nuclear-free world, that he didn't expect to see it in his lifetime, and I kind of feel that way about Security Council expansion. I mean, there, you know, everybody, it's something that everybody, you know, realizes that there's a huge imbalance in power at the UN, that it's, that, you know, that it kind of reflects the, you know, the world in the mid-1940s after World War II. And there have been a number of efforts, I mean, very involved, intense efforts, you know, since 1995 to try and reform the council and expand it. And, you know, all the permanent five members of the Security Council, they all say they want an expanded council, but, they aren't pushing it very aggressively. Maybe in their heart of hearts, they really don't want it to happen.
Does it matter? For India?
It does matter, and I think it will happen in our lifetime, but it won't be overnight. It'll be a gradual, step-by-step process.
And why does it matter? What would it change for the average Indian?
Simply because, I mean, can you imagine a world by, say, 2025, where India is the third largest economy after U.S. and China, and it does not have a seat at the table? I mean, that sounds silly. I don't think the United
States. But beyond the symbolism of the seat at the table, does it matter?
It's more than symbolism. I mean, you have a Security Council which is vested with powers to, you know, prevent wars, wage wars. You know, there are all kinds of implications, of being a member of the Security Council. So, You bet it's important to India, and you bet it's important to the Indian people. There's a huge, momentum within India for that, particularly over the last 5 years or so. India has really stepped up and is actually demanding that reforms take place, and principally changes in the UN Security Council. I mean, this Security Council is a relic of Second World War, and it needs to be recast. It needs to be expanded. The world is a different place now.
We're going to run out of time shortly, but I want to play two other clips from two other heads of state who spoke yesterday that seemed to be somewhat in opposition. And I want to know if each of you think this first clip of the Swedish Prime Minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt, is kind of a more accurate summation of things as compared to the bleaker view of French President Nicolas Sarkozy, which we will hear second. This is the Swedish Prime Minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt.
Globalization is good. Through globalization, hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty. Information, ideas, and inventions, goods and services, it all moves more quickly from one country to another.
Hey, everything's great. Globalization is good, says the Swedish Prime Minister. Not so, Nicolas Sarkozy.
We are right in the middle of an unprecedented financial and economic crisis. We are on the threshold of a planetary ecological disaster. We must, right now, invent a new world where the follies of yesterday will no longer be possible.
Colm Lynch from the Washington Post, briefly, interesting contrast between the French perspective and the Swedish view of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that, some people are hoping that this whole debate on the, sort of failings of capitalism and the free market as the Swedish are kind of suggestion, don't swing too far in the other direction. I imagine it depends where you're sitting in terms of how you view this. If you're, one of the rising East Asian powers, who've profited or who have succeeded during this period of globalization, you probably still feel like it's not such a bad thing. And if you're sort of in a marginal part of the world where you haven't been doing that well, particularly in Africa, you might feel different. Maybe our Indian colleague, a country that has been doing quite well sort of economically, might have an interesting view on that.
And Chidanand, very, very briefly on this, as they head off to Pittsburgh now to have the G20 summit on capitalism?
Yeah, I'm actually in Pittsburgh right now. And you bet, India is all for globalization. This is a country which has thrived over the last, 15, 20 years, ever since it embraced, globalization. And part of it has to do with demographics. We are a young country, and, we are young, we are hungry, we are competitive, and it's a pity that, there are some countries which don't have the kind of demographic dividends that India and China has. And they're the ones who are, feeling hard done by this whole globalization.
Can you each give me 30 seconds on world reaction at the UN to the Obama speech yesterday? Was this like, oh, my God, it's a new day in America and the world because Obama sounded so different from Bush? Or is it somewhat less than that, more skepticism about how much change the words actually represent? Colm Lynch, real quick.
Yeah, I just summoned the council this morning. He's kind of still electrifying. Everybody's trying to get in a position to shake his hand. Even Gaddafi yesterday was talking about, after sort of a railing on the U.S., but was talking about how excited he was about Obama, how he wished he'd be president forever in the United States. So still a lot of excitement, but still a kind of feeling that, they'd like to see him taking more tough positions, clear position on where he's going on foreign issues like climate change, Middle East, et cetera. They want more progress.
Chidanand, anything different to say?
Absolutely. I mean, I hear of numbers, Obama's numbers going down in the United States, but I can tell you he can go to India and run for office and he'll win there. except, like Colin said, we're still looking for greater clarity in terms of numbers and metrics about various issues, including rollback of nuclear weapons.
Okay. Barack Obama for governor of Punjab. Chidanand Rajgata, foreign editor and the U.S. correspondent for The Times of India. Colm Lynch, U.N. correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you both so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue in a minute with our door-to-door commuting series. Today, new technology and your commute. Call us up with your favorite Subway app for your mobile device or anything else. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Buzz Paswell, our transportation guru, will be back to talk about new technology down under. Stay with us.